Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The modern Olympics were resurrected with a vision of promoting internationalism, peace, and equity. The intent was to keep politics out of the games. But today's guest, former professional soccer player Jules Boykoff, writes, quote, "In reality, the Olympics are political through and through. The marching, the flags, the national anthems, the alliances with corporate sponsors, the labor exploitation behind the athletic apparel labels, the treatment of indigenous peoples, the marginalization of the poor and the working class, the selection of Olympic host cities, it's all political. To say the Olympics transcends politics is to conjure fantasy," end quote. In his new book, Power Games, A Political History of the Olympics, Jules Boykoff meticulously details the game's rocky beginnings, geopolitical tensions, and its modern-day hyper-commercialization. Jules Boykoff is a sports writer who has covered every Olympics and World Cup over the last two decades. He competed on the U.S. Olympic team as a soccer player in the late 80s and early 90s, and he's author of several books, including Activism and the Olympics and Celebration, Capitalism, and the Olympic Games. Jules is professor of politics and government at Pacific University in Forest Grove, Oregon, and he's speaking at the Green Arcade Bookstore tonight at 7 o'clock, 1680 Market Street in San Francisco. And Jules joins us in studio. Hi, Jules. Welcome to the show.
Hey, hi. Great to be here. Thanks.
It's great to have you, and congratulations on your book. Now, you were on the Olympic team as a soccer player in the late 80s and the 90s. At what point did you decide that you wanted to write about politics and the history of the Olympics?
Well, actually, I suppose it goes back to when I was 19 years old and playing for the U.S. Olympic soccer team in this international tournament in France. And the first match that I played in was against Brazil, actually. Had a real nice big crowd there cheering loud for Brazil. But it wasn't just that they were cheering for Brazil. Hey, I could understand that. I probably would have cheered for Brazil, too, if I wasn't playing against them. But they also seemed to be cheering against us, against the United States. And I kind of chalked it up at the time to just a love of Brazil, but we went on to play Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia, and the Soviet Union. Yeah, this was in 1990. And we got a similar cold French shoulder pretty much everywhere we went. And that got my admittedly naive 19-year-old mind cranking a little bit harder to try to figure these things out. And I guess you could say that put me on the path of thinking about the wider issues off of the soccer field and off of the track oval and off of the speed skating oval and try to figure out what was really going on there.
Well, you were only 19 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Did you talk with your teammates and your coaches about these boos?
Oh, yeah, I definitely talked about it. I was really curious in trying to figure it out, and we didn't really come to any conclusions at that time, but definitely put me on this path of thinking about, well, U.S. foreign policy, why would somebody cheer against the United States? And I think I realized pretty quickly there are a number of good reasons to do that.
It's so interesting because there has been a lot of attention today on what you're writing about. For example, the Summer Games kick off in Rio de Janeiro next month. They're just a couple weeks away. And there's so much reporting about what's happening in Rio, massive protests. Rio recently declared a state of public calamity. They're dealing with a major financial crisis. And so that has delayed improvements to infrastructure, construction of game sites. Professors are speaking out. This is getting so much more attention, and it seems like it's just happened in the last couple of years.
Well, what's going on in Rio really magnifies a lot of the problems that are wider Olympic problems. And when I lived in Rio last year from August through December, I would say the general idea from the people I spoke with was a shrug. We have bigger problems. We have a president who's on the road to impeachment. We have an economy that's tanking. I think now that window has shut of disinterest and everybody's eyes are on the Olympics. The global media are descending there. And we have a serious problems. I mean, body parts washed up on Copacabana Beach, right near to where the volleyball will be played. And so there's all sorts of problems. But I guess for me, it's important to note that a lot of these problems can't just be blamed on Rio. In fact, they're Olympic problems. They're wider problems that crop up to various degrees in every single host city for the Olympics in the 21st century, whether it's Beijing, whether it's Vancouver, whether it's London, whether it's Sochi in Russia.
And so tell us more about that. There's a bigger issue at play here.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I think there are four main trends that we see in the 21st century when a city decides to host the Olympics. And one of those is high costs. It's sort of like Etch-a-Sketch economics, where the hosts say it's going to be only, so let's say, $3.8 billion, as they said in London. Then they shake up the Etch-a-Sketch, and in reality, it's more like $18 billion in London. So brand new number, high cost through the roof. That's one trend. A second one has to be displacement of local people who find themselves in front of the Olympic steamroller. 1.5 million people were displaced in China in the lead up to the Beijing Olympics. In Rio, we see about 77,000 people who've been pushed out of the way since 2009 when Rio was awarded the Games. A third trend has to be militarization of public space. Basically, a local security forces use the Olympics like their own private ATM machine. They get all the weapons that they could never get during normal political times, the special laws that they need. In Brazil, in Rio, we'll see 85,000 security officials. That's double the number that we saw in London. And I'd say, you know, the last big trend that we've seen in the 21st century with Olympic hosts has to be the false promises, the sometimes staggering false promises. In Rio, as I'm sure we'll talk about, it's water. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is just such a crushing blow to the people of Rio who are given this really tantalizing promise that their water would be cleaned up, spurred on by the Olympics, but nothing of the sort has happened.
So let's talk about that, because we're talking about the Summer Olympics, so there are a lot of water sports. Mm-hmm. And in a recent New York Times op-ed, you report that every day, 169 million gallons of untreated human waste flows into the bay. It's Rio's Guanabara, where Olympic sailing and windsurfing will be staged. But you point out that the focus as the Games approach has been on how that polluted water will affect the athletes and overlooks the harm imposed every day on the city's residents.
That's absolutely right. I was in Rio last week, and I went around Guanabara Bay where all this pollution was just freely floating into the bay. You'd see mattresses, you'd see water bottles, you'd see animal carcasses, punctured soccer balls, just floating freely into the bay. And it wasn't supposed to be this way. If we just step back to 2009, when Rio put forth its bid, it promised that 80% of the water flowing into Guanabara Bay would be treated for human sewage. Recent estimates have found that in reality, it's about 21% of the water flowing in is treated. And this is really dangerous stuff. I mean, you can't help but smell this stuff. I mean, it's an awful stench as you approach. There's carpets full of water bottles, broken toys, trash that are essentially strangling out the mangroves that are supposed to filter the water system around Guanabara Bay. And it is dangerous. I mean, if you accidentally consume 3 teaspoons of water, 3 measly teaspoons, you have a 99% chance of contracting a virus. And of course, if you're an open water swimmer who's going to be in one of these venues, you're going to be concerned. You're almost for sure going to inadvertently gulp down 3 measly teaspoons. But as you said, Rose, I mean, the bigger point, I think, and the wider travesty that we should really consider is that the people of Rio were expecting to get this. And they're the ones that are going to continue to live in this water long after the honchos from the International Olympic Committee and all the athletes helicopter back home to their safe places.
And yet, even though this is happening and even though Rio is dealing with a financial crisis, the International Olympic Committee Coordination Commission Chair, Nawal Al-Mutawakkil, thank you, said last week that the Brazilians have transformed the city through a legacy vision that they have made a reality by creating a legacy that will benefit local citizens and the whole country for decades. This was just said last week.
It's amazing the sort of shimmering scrim of promises that are still floated. But if you just poke at that scrim even a little bit, you see that there's really nothing behind it. you know, Ms. Mutawakkel previously had made a joke about the water when asked about it at a press conference. She said, oh, we should just go jump in that water right now. And her colleagues at the International Olympic Committee have had the temerity to suggest that because of the Olympics, awareness around these water issues has actually improved. So people from Rio should actually be thanking the Olympics because now, look, everyone knows about the water. That, by the way, is a massive insult. When I talk to people in Rio, everyday people of all political stripes, they were furious at that kind of comment, as if they didn't know that they had water issues, serious, grave water issues to contend with.
Can you give us a sense of what goes on behind the scenes? Because we often hear about these promises and how things will get better for the local citizens. Talk about the deals that are struck behind the scenes. When you say host committee, for example, and then the International Olympic Committee, mm-hmm. can you talk about those relationships?
Sure, because the International Olympic Committee votes around 7 years before the actual Olympics on who is going to become the next host city. Once they make that really important decision, they largely hand over the reins to the local organizing committee, which is typically comprised of local technocrats as well as well-connected political and economic elites. Because let's not forget, there are people who do benefit from the Olympics, and that's the political and economic elites, and there's some staggering examples of how that's playing out in Rio. What happens is the International Olympic Committee essentially turns over the reins, and then they do these coordination commission visits and check in to make sure everything's proceeding according to snuff. But what this provides is a sort of jurisdictional shimmying that can happen where the International Olympic Committee can say, hey, it's not us who decided to build all these stadiums. It was the local organizing committee. You can't blame us. And then the local organizing committee can blame the local governments for not moving fast enough. And in Rio, there's three different levels of local government. So what this happens often with the Olympics when it comes down to actually carrying them out is everybody can avoid responsibility for the way things are actually playing out. And so that's one of the big problems of the Olympics is that where does the accountability eventually mm-hmm. lie? And I think the International Olympic Committee needs to take a much stronger role there. After all, they have $1 billion in reserves, according to their own records. They have plenty of money floating around. They just opened ground on a new headquarters in Lausanne, Switzerland. And when these members of the International Olympic Committee come into Rio, they will not only have the nicest hotels to stay in, free travel around the city, luscious cheese plates and such to eat, but they can actually claim $900 per day in per diem. $900 if you're on the executive committee of the IOC. To put that in perspective, in Jocinha, which is the largest favela in Rio, the average monthly wage is $240. That's before the economic collapse. So the point I'm trying to make is there is money circulating through this system, and I think the International Olympic Committee needs to be more accountable for circulating it in a more equitable way.
And the $1 billion in reserves, where did this money come from?
Well, a lot of it comes from corporate sponsors. I mean, one activist I interviewed in Vancouver during the Vancouver 2010 Extended Olympic Moment, a guy named Amjo Hall, told me that the Olympics are a corporate franchise that you buy with public money. And I think he was highlighting for us that corporations have a huge role in the way the Olympics play out, whether it's the Worldwide Olympic Program, including McDonald's and Coca-Cola, because, you know, you always think of those firms when you think of health and Olympics and sports, right? But, you know, also other companies that are involved in how to sponsor the Olympics, and not to mention NBC, which is, of course, broadcasting the games. They forked over $4.4 billion to host the Olympics on TV from 2014 to 2020, and another almost $8 billion for the period after that. So there's a lot of money at stake. Money is circulating through the system. It just tends to go to places it already resided before.
And do those news anchors still wear the swoosh on their jackets when they're live at the Olympics?
Well, you know, there's this interlocking network of corporate sponsors, and yes, there's a synergy, as they like to refer to it. And it also boxes out other sponsors, and that's where we've seen some athletes speak up and say, you know, I have a sponsor, say a shoe sponsor of Brooks, say some track athletes, and yet I can't actually have that sponsor seen during the Olympics. because of this special rule. It's called Rule 40 within the Olympic Charter that gives prime advertising territory to Olympic sponsors only. And this got really extreme in some instances, like London, where there was a shop. I was in London for the 2012 Olympics, and there was a small coffee shop who put on their menu something called the Flaming Torch Olympic Breakfast Baguette. And the local organizers said, whoa, hey, whoa, that's a violation of our brand, and you can't have a Flaming Torch Breakfast Baguette on your menu. And they actually had to take it off. So it gets pretty extreme, the measures they're willing to take to protect the brand.
Jules Boykoff is author of the new book, Power Games, A Political History of the Olympics. Jules covered every Olympics and World Cup over the last two decades. He competed in the Olympics on the U.S. soccer team in the late 80s and early 90s. And he'll be speaking tonight at the Green Arcade Bookstore at 7 o'clock, 1680 Market Street here in San Francisco. And Jules writes about the history of the Olympics. And we're going to talk later about what needs to change to ensure that everyday people in Olympic City are not further marginalized and manipulated. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. If you're an Olympics fan, what changes have you seen over the years? What about politics playing out? And what are your thoughts about these issues that we've been getting? Well, there's been more media coverage for sure about how local people are standing up to some of this exploitation, all of these promises, many of these promises that aren't followed through. What are your thoughts about that? And if you are from an area where the Olympics was hosted, what changes did you see before and after? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And Jules, before we get to calls, for people who might not be a fan of the Olympics or a fan of sports, why should they care about these issues?
Well, I think that we should care because a lot of other people care. And the Olympics actually provides this really unique opportunity to talk to people who we don't normally get to talk about politics with. You know, for a decade, I wrote about state repression and media repression. And when I went to Thanksgiving and tried to talk to my family members who didn't share the same political ideals as me, it was a tough road to hoe that. But if I go and I talk about sports or the Olympics, we can actually talk about all these things that really matter to me, such as capitalism, such as state repression, such as the indigenous people's relationships to politics and economics. We can get at all those things through sports. And so it's a real conversation starter. I think if for no other reason, it should be tactical that we should be open to these things.
Well, let's hear from our first caller, Ruthann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruthann. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. I wanted to know if Jules Boykoff knew of, if there's any nexus with similar type things happening with other sporting organizations, maybe the wrong word, like the NBA for basketball or the NFL for football or the World Tennis Association or all the other sporting venues.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you, Ruthann. I would say the most direct comparison for what we're talking about here with the Olympics has to be with FIFA, the world governing body for soccer that oversees the Women's and Men's World Cup, where we've seen gobsmacking corruption, tons of money circulating through the system, and not unlike the Olympics that have gotten a lot of media attention, as Rose was pointing out in recent times. Same with FIFA. I mean, their president, Sepp Blatter, was recently essentially tossed out of office, and the pressure continues to mount on that organization as the corruption findings continue to emerge. So I would say that's the most direct comparison. But another one that I think for people here in the United States to maybe think about is when we build stadiums. Because a lot of the same dynamics that go into building stadiums are at play with the Olympics, primarily the sort of lopsided public-private partnerships that we hear about, where the public tends to pay and shoulder the burden for building stadiums. And then the private entities, the owners of the teams, they swirl around and they sort of scoop up the rewards, not unlike the corporate sponsors at the Olympics who also scoop up the rewards that are to be had. So I think you're right to compare to other sports. But for me, those are probably the two most direct examples of the dynamics we're discussing.
And because there's so much more awareness about a lot of these issues, can you point to any one change that has happened as a result?
Sure. Well, there's both small changes and there are bigger changes that are in play. Maybe I'll talk to one very concrete material change that happened in Vancouver during the 2010 Olympics. This remarkable set of activists rose up to challenge the Olympic machine. This was local Indigenous organizers, local poverty organizers, lawyers teamed up as well, anarchists. There were many people who came together, and they pushed for housing changes during the Olympics. And in fact, during the 2010 Vancouver Olympics, activists seized space along West Hastings Street in the downtown East Side, and they refused to budge until a number of homes, more than 80 homes, were given to people who previously didn't have homes. So, you know, this can be a leverage point during the Olympic moment for activists to sort of piggyjack the games, if you will, piggyback off the popularity of the Olympics and hijack them for political gain. So there's small changes like that that we've seen, and there's many examples of that. But there's also bigger changes in the works right now, because the fact of the matter is fewer and fewer cities are game for the games, if you will. There are fewer cities that actually want to host the Olympics for many of the reasons that we've been talking about. And the International Olympic Committee is well aware of that, and so they've opened the gates to all sorts of changes. They haven't made them official yet, but they've suggested that there could be multiple city hosts or multiple country hosts, and then you could spread the games in ways that didn't have the massive impact that they already have now on local populations.
Well, thank you for calling in, Ruth Ann. Would you also say that more athletes are speaking out about these issues?
I would say there are a lot of athletes to keep an eye on as we move toward Rio. I mean, thinking about the history of the political history of the Olympics, there are lots of amazing examples of athletes. I mean, it goes way back to 1906 and moving forward. One story I love from 1906 was an athlete named Peter O'Connor. He was Irish, and he was forced to compete for Great Britain at the 1906 Olympics because Ireland didn't have a National Olympic Committee, and Ireland was ruled by Westminster at the time. He was a fervent anti-colonialist, and when he won his silver medal and he saw the Union Jack hoisted up on the flagpole, he sprinted over to the flagpole, he shimmied up that thing, and he held the Union Jack to the side and waved an Erin go bragh, Ireland forever flag. Instead, his buddy Conlay, he stood guard at the bottom and waved a flag as well and fended off Greek police that were trying to stop that action. And then we, of course, think of 1968, that iconic moment not just of Olympic history but of world history, where John Carlos and Tommy Smith stood on the medal stand in Mexico City, put their black glove fists into the Mexico City sky, while Peter Norman, the Australian sprinter, stood aside them in solidarity wearing an Olympic Project for Human Rights button. And I think both those examples show us that when there are movements, vibrant, progressive movements in place fighting for change, wider change in society, it sort of scythes open this space in front of athletes who can become athlete activists. And that points us to today with Rio, because we have a number of important movements, perhaps primary among them right now, Black Lives Matter, who have created a terrifically important conversation that we need to be having right now. And there are a number of athletes who are going to Rio, for example, the prominent NBA star Carmelo Anthony, who have spoken out about issues around racial injustice in the United States and abroad. And there was a contingent of Black Lives Matter activists who recently traveled to Rio de Janeiro to try to create a transnational conversation about police brutality and start to connect the dots around the world. So I think this is one of the things for your listeners to really keep an eye on as we move ahead. There have been a number of athletes who have said the Olympics aren't doing what they say they're going to do, and we need to speak out.
Jules Boykoff is author of the new book, Power Games, A Political History of the Olympics. He has covered every Olympics and World Cup over the last two decades. He competed in the Olympics on the U.S. soccer team in the late 80s and early 90s. And he'll be speaking at the Green Arcade Bookstore here in San Francisco tonight at 7 o'clock. It's at 1680 Market Street. And we're going to talk after the break with Jules about other changes that need to be made to ensure that everyday people in Olympic City are not marginalized and manipulated. And what changes would you like to see? This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Whether you're on your phone, your tablet, or your desktop, it's now much easier to participate in Your Call. It's better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Leave a comment at the show's website, set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @yourcallradio. Coming up in a half an hour, it's BBC's World Have Your Say here on 91.7 KALW. Stay tuned.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, investigative journalist David K. Johnston will join us to talk about Donald Trump. Trump officially clinched the GOP nomination yesterday, despite reports of tax evasion, three lawsuits alleging fraud, racist policy proposals, among many other scandals. So what does his political and economic history tell us about what a Trump presidency would look like? That is tomorrow. And then Friday, it's our media roundtable, and we'll be discussing media coverage of the Republican National Convention and the events taking place in Turkey. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, I'm joined by Jules Boykoff. We're talking about his latest book, Power Games, A Political History of the Olympics. And so much media attention is now focused on what happens to all of these promises. They're greatly exaggerated. We always hear that the Olympics will improve living conditions for the locals, but that really doesn't happen, especially when you're talking about marginalized people. So what needs to change? And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you've been to the Olympics, and then let's say you walked outside, what did you see? If you're from an area where the Olympics have taken place, talk about what it was like before, during, and after. 866-798-8255. And if you're a fan, what changes would you like to see? You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or tweet us @yourcallradio. And let's go next to Karen in Berkeley. Hi, Karen. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose.
Hi.
Hi, Rose. Yeah, so I wanted to let everybody know about a great little documentary made by The Guardian. It's online. You can go to The Guardian newspaper online and press Rio de Janeiro, that all the hospital workers basically have been, they're not getting paid. The police are on strike. The garbage workers are on strike. They're not picking up the trash. The city is in a complete bedlam, and the corrupt government is holding back paying for just social services while the Olympics go on, looking like they're just, you know, nothing is wrong with them. So this is a great expose. I suggest everybody look at it, about what's really going on in Rio, and it's a big mess. And I think the Olympics should not even go forward until the situation with the people that work there. I mean, if somebody gets sick there, there's not going to be anybody in the hospital, especially with the Zika virus. So that's what I wanted to let everybody know about.
All right. Is that the one with the professors were interviewed, Karen?
I'm not really sure. I think they have a few of them, but this is one we just saw last night.
Okay.
And it has it's interviewing people that work in hospitals, teachers,
right,
in schools, police, firefighters, garbage people, that sanitation people. They're not getting paid.
Hmm.
But then you hear about these people getting $900 per diem. It just makes you sick.
Right.
So I just go up there and you'll see it. It's a little documentary. It's not very long, maybe about 10 minutes, but it really shows exactly what is really going on in Rio behind the corruption of the Olympics, which is corrupt in every city it's ever been in. We all know that.
Well, thank you so much. I watched the first maybe 5 minutes of this documentary. Really excellent. And so now that this information is getting out, Jules, and the Olympics are supposed to start in Rio in just a couple of weeks, what action do you think should be taken?
Well, first of all, just to piggyback off what Karen was saying, I mean, budgets are absolutely ethical documents, and the spending, where we put the spending, shows our priorities as a society, or at least the elites that are organizing the Olympics, their priorities. So they're putting it toward the Olympics, while, as Karen is pointing out, people are not getting paid. The police were at the airport last week in Rio when I was there saying, "Welcome to hell." They had a big sign that said, "Welcome to hell." That's the police, by the way. State of public calamity declared by the state of Rio de Janeiro. One maybe wrinkle in that, though, is that this is a once-in-a-generation chance, perhaps, for unions to make a big burst forward. We saw that in London, savvy unions making the most of the state of exception moment to get gains for their rank and file. So I think we should also consider this as an opportunity for working people in a certain respect. But in terms of what should be done moving forward, I think for starters, we just absolutely have to control the costs of the Olympics. They have spiraled way out of control, and there are many ways that you could do this to reduce the gigantism of the Games. Second of all, we absolutely need to have accountability on the part of the International Olympic Committee and on the part of local organizers so that they don't get the money released, the money spigot stays shut until they meet certain benchmarks of their promises, so that it doesn't all of a sudden come to the end and go, well, I guess we didn't meet that promise in terms of water. And I think a minor concession, a minor one, yet perhaps important in terms of helping people feel involved, is to give tickets to everyday people who can't afford them. Rio's mediagenic mayor, Eduardo Paes, who will be the face of the Olympics politically when they happen in a couple weeks here, Eduardo Paes promised just a couple years ago that he was going to give 1.2 million tickets, free tickets, to people in Rio who could not afford to go to the Games so that they could have an Olympic experience. Has he given 1.2 million? No. He's given 47,000 is the last I saw, so like something around 4% of his original promise.
How much are the tickets?
Well, they can depend on the sport. They're actually quite expensive, to tell you the truth. I mean, some of these games, like if you want to watch the, say, women's Olympic soccer final, you're going to pay upwards of $300. But on the flip side, right now, because of the fact that the ticket sales have been sluggish, they're actually reducing prices. And so we'll see what happens there. They're way behind schedule in terms of their prices. And I think in terms of the sports, I mentioned soccer there, which is tremendously popular and people can play from around the world. I think that actually points us down a path of the Olympics for reform in other ways. So how could we democratize sports? You know, back in the early days of the Olympics, as I write about in Power Games, tug-of-war was actually a really important and very popular sport. What's great about tug-of-war? You need a rope, some muscly people, and you pull, right? How different is that from, say, dressage, which is a form of equestrian, basically horse ballet, where you have to spend in the neighborhood of $70,000 a year to maintain your horse so that it can go to the Olympics and engage in dressage? I mean, who can do that? Very small numbers of people. So
not very fun for the horse either.
No. In fact, just a small historical tidbit, Mitt Romney, former presidential candidate from the United States, had a horse called Rafalka who competed in the 2012 Olympics in London. So it's that kind of privileged sliver of the global 1% that can afford their Rafalka, where the rest of us, we could probably play tug of war.
Before we get back to calls, I want to ask you about cost in Rio. Again, the Summer Games begin in a couple weeks. It's supposed to cost $12 billion. Is that the latest number?
Well, the estimates are from the outset were supposed to be between $10 and $12 billion, but some economists, credible economists, have said the price tag is more like $20 billion.
Wow.
Dollars, and that's common for the Olympics.
And 40% comes from public funds?
That is what the organizers of the Olympics say, but I think that we should approach that statistic with a whole lot of healthy skepticism because it masks huge public subsidies that are going into these games in the neighborhood of $1 billion of subsidies, according to one group of Brazilian economists and sociologists. So $1 billion is not accounted for there. Plus, when you hear that 40% figure only being paid by the public, that includes the part of the city that's being developed that is heavily private and has nothing to do with the Olympics. I mean, there's no Olympics going on there. They include that, and that lifts the percentage of private input and includes some Trump towers. Turns out Donald Trump is building in the northern part of Rio as well. About 1.5 of his towers are being built there. And in a weird way, Trump actually is a perfect symbol of the Olympics because for him, it's all about spectacle. It's all about speculation. And that's definitely two dynamics at play with the Olympics, political spectacle and land speculation. situation.
Earlier, you said that the average monthly wage in Rio is $220 a month.
$240 in Jocinho, which is the biggest favela, yeah.
Okay, so $240 a month. And you also said that the political elite in Brazil are going to benefit from the Olympics. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes. Let me give you a specific example of that. The Olympic Village, where athletes will stay during the Olympics, is being built by a firm called Carvalho Hoskin. And they'll turn these Olympic Village dwellings into luxury housing after the game. Previous Olympics have said, oh, we're going to have part social housing. Unfortunately, they haven't followed through with their promises. But in Brazil, there's no varnish. Carvalho Hoskin has been planning all along to turn these into luxury condos and flip them into monster profits. And when Carlos Carvalho, who's the head of Carvalho Hoskin, was asked by The Guardian what he thought of what's going to happen with this place after the Olympics, he said, don't worry. This is not going to be a place for poor people. This is going to be a place for nobles, for elites. He was very clear about it. And he said it again later to the BBC, so it wasn't just some sort of one-off mistake. They're actually calling this place Ilha Pura, which means pure island. And it's not even actually a geophysical island. It's definitely a social island where if you want to get in, you need to have the right class background. So that's just one example. Another shocking one to me is the golf course. They are bringing golf back to the Olympics after a 112-year hiatus. And Rio already had two golf courses there. They bragged about them, in fact, in their Olympic bidding documents. But they decided to build a brand new course. And guess what? This new course cuts over the edge of a nature reserve where there are endangered species and everything. That led to a huge activist outpouring that occupied that space for a while. But they were pushed aside very aggressively, I might say, as well. And they've built this course. And the deal was that if this local developer, his name's Pascoal Moro, if he spent the $20 to $30 million to develop the golf course, he could also build 140 condominiums around the edge of the golf course and sell those at a minimum of about $2 million per 140 units, right? So you don't have to be a math whiz to figure out there's huge profits here. So again, this takes us actually back to your previous question, which is it seems like there's private donations happening to make these Olympics occur. But if you look behind that, yeah, they're donating $20 to $30 million to build the golf course, but they're going to walk away with many, many times more than that in profits.
And the government signs off on this?
They do. In fact, they go out of their way. Eduardo Paes, who I mentioned before, the mayor of Rio, right before Christmas 2012, he held a special session at City Hall that basically did away with any kind of environmental impact assessments, those kind of pesky things. It allowed this developer, Pascoal Moro, to build his condos around the golf course at a higher level, more floors, which, of course, means more money for him as he can build more condos. So, yeah, this is definitely happening in concert with the political heavy hitters in Rio.
Oh, well, let's hear from Anne, who lived in Rio a couple of years ago, Anne Noel in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, I can't say I lived there. I visited 2 years ago, and I just wanted to make one comment and then a suggestion, and I'm really enjoying the show. The first was, we went and toured the soccer stadium, the iconic Maracanã, I hope I'm saying that correctly, and there's a little bridge, you know, that you cross over to get there, and flowing underneath is open sewage. It just stinks to high heaven. It's going, you know, so they built all this money for the stadium for the World Cup, and or spiffed it up, and then there's the sewage coming from the favela. We went to another favela, and there was a brand new Olympic size swimming pool, and the first facilities for people in that favela, and it was closed because they didn't have the staffing for it. So my suggestion was, why couldn't there be a fund set up as, you know, ironclad guarantee for a community to take the Olympics, to have a trust fund set up for local sports once they leave? Because otherwise I don't see anything going to the local community afterwards.
Yes, thank you for that. I mean, there have been previous Olympics that have made grand promises about sport legacy, and maybe prime among those is the London 2012 Olympics that said that there was going to be this trail of sporty people running around the UK after the games, and that hasn't materialized. But I think you're onto something. It needs funding. These things don't happen by magic, and the feel-good factor of the Olympics wears off after a while. And so I think you put your finger on it. This is about money. This is about setting money aside. And as we've been discussing, there's plenty of money circulating through the system, and why not set it aside for something that would benefit the everyday people of the city? I'm totally with you on that.
And who comes up with the ultimate cost? Who decides that we need 4 new stadiums and 2 new golf courses? Who makes these decisions?
Well, it's interesting. The International Olympic Committee likes to say that it's up to local organizing committees to decide how many new stadiums to build. But the reality is that to host the Olympics, you need to meet a certain quality for the athletes. So in a weird way, it's like the International Olympic Committee sort of takes a I don't do cocaine, I just like the way it smells argument. You know, it's like, hey, you don't need to build all those stadiums, but I guess you kind of do to host the Olympics. So I think at the end of the day, it's the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, and their very high standards for what these places need to look like that is part of the issue. And then what happens in the wake of these games all too often is they're left to be maintained by the local people, like Anne just pointed out there with the swimming pool, and that costs money. And those costs are often not factored into the equation. Plus, I mean, you'll have multiple stadiums in Rio. They're saying they're going to use them for the Brazilian Olympic teams, and that could be a positive path forward. But the likely outcome will be that there'll be white elephant stadiums that are massively underused. And we've seen that across the 21st century. Even the Bird's Nest, the much-celebrated Bird's Nest in Beijing, the Ai Weiwei beautifully designed Bird's Nest, is rarely used. I mean, it's used only a few times a year. Some guy, like, did a tightrope act across it, and that was one of the big events of the year a few years back. So it's the white elephant syndrome, and in Brazil we'll have a herd of them.
Now, are there any major differences between, say, when the Olympics goes to London, a very wealthy city, or when the Olympics goes to Rio, where, as you point out, in one favela, people are making $220 a month?
Mm-hmm. I think if we focus our attention on the displacement dynamic that I was talking about before that's common to the Olympics, even London, there were 1,200 people displaced in London. We see different dynamics depending on where you go. So with more developed places like London or Vancouver, for example, you see instead of the sort of sharp-edged eviction and displacement that we saw in Beijing and Rio, instead of that, you see the velvet glove of gentrification. So London 2012, the areas around the Olympic Stadium, Newham, Stratford, these places are massively gentrified now. So people who had lived there for decades and decades with their families have been pushed out of the area. And that also comes with the Olympics. We've been talking a lot about eviction, and that's really important to keep an eye on because the most marginalized people are being sort of, in some cases, violently kicked out of their homes. But gentrification also has negative effects on everyday people in the Olympic city.
Today we're speaking with Jules Boykoff about his new book, Power Games, A Political History of the Olympics. And Jules will be speaking tonight at the Green Arcade Bookstore in San Francisco. It starts at 7 o'clock, and it's at 1680 Market Street. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. We have a couple emails. Ron says, how very refreshing it is to hear an athlete who is aware of and concerned about the world beyond the sporting arena, who connects the dots while having the courage to discuss with such eloquence the rampant greed and exploitation that has poisoned what was originally a most laudable movement. But it's not merely the Olympics. This trend has tainted all so-called amateur and professional sports over the decades. Thank you for speaking up and addressing these vital issues. We have another email from Carol who says, my friend, a Canadian friend, is a lifelong Vancouver resident. They were told a vote would decide if the 2010 Olympics would be held in Vancouver. Residents voted against the measure, but the Olympics went ahead anyway in Vancouver. They were also told one venue would be used for building more housing. That particular site still sits vacant. My friend was surprised anyone would consider Vancouver for the Winter Olympics because the climate isn't great for snow, and the skeptics were proven right.
Yeah, Vancouver was really interesting because they did have a public referendum in the lead up to the games. Actually, it won approval, that referendum, And it was, of course, funded massively by people who wanted to host the Olympics. So there was a huge imbalance in terms of the amount of money put forth. But Vancouver's an interesting pivot because more and more cities now that are considering hosting the Games are holding these referenda that allow people to weigh in. And what we're seeing now in the last few years is that when there's a smidgen of democracy put in front of the electorate, they say thanks but no thanks when it comes to the Olympics. So let's just take the example of the 2022 Winter Olympics. There were a number of cities that were interested in hosting those, but by the end, when the International Olympic Committee voted just recently, there were only two standing, and that was Almaty, Kazakhstan, and Beijing, China, two authoritarian societies. Everyone else dropped out. So Krakow, Poland, voters said no. Oslo, Norway, elected officials said no. Cantons in Switzerland, no. And there were a number of other cities that just said no. And this is what we're seeing with the Olympics. And I think we can actually thank the activists and the people in Vancouver who stood up. I really view that as a pivotal moment in the history of the Games that really rose awareness around these issues that we've been talking about today.
And there have been massive, massive protests in Rio and Brazil. What happens to the people who are displaced?
Well, some of them do get new homes. Their communities are totally shattered, of course, but they're moved to other places. Some receive settlements. It very much varies depending on your ability to negotiate with the government. So people are getting new homes. They're not part of the communities that they formerly lived in, and typically they're not as good as their houses that they had before. But there are exceptions. I mean, some people are making off with significant amounts of money and able to start their lives over again, even though having their communities shattered.
You have so many interesting pieces of information here about the history of the Olympics. You write about the French aristocrat Baron Pierre de Coubertin, credited as the founder of the modern Olympics. The game were far from equitable, especially for women and anyone who wasn't white. And there's so many amazing acts of resistance that developed in response to the racism, the colonialism, and the elitism born out of the modern Olympics. And I love the stories you tell in here about Native Americans. This is something that we don't really learn much about or think about when we talk about and think about the Olympics. Can you talk about what you learned about Native Americans who played the games and also who resisted?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, there were numerous Native, First Nations, Aboriginal athletes who've had tremendous success at the Olympics, and I write about them in the book. There's Jim Thorpe, the prominent Sac and Fox and Potawatomi Native American from Oklahoma, who was the sort of indisputable champion, really, of the 1912 Olympics in Stockholm. Unfortunately, he was stripped of his medals after that because he had played semi-professional baseball in the summer and gotten paid for that and was therefore viewed as professional. There was a huge battle that ensued, and his medals were eventually restored to his family. And I get into archives, and I draw from some of the letters that people wrote the International Olympic Committee saying, come on, give this guy his medals back. There are a number of other athletes that I write about in the book. Damien Hooper from the 2012 London Olympics, an Aboriginal boxer from Australia who walked into the ring wearing a T-shirt that had the Aboriginal flag on it. And when the International Olympic Committee said, hey, you can't do that, that's not the official flag of the Olympics, he said, you know what, I'm representing Australia, but I'm also representing my Aboriginal peoples. And so there's a lot to really celebrate about Indigenous success and courage at the Olympics. But there's an uglier side as well, and I definitely get at that in the Olympic book that you're talking about, Power Games. For example, the 1904 Olympics that happened in St. Louis, there were a number of Indigenous peoples from around the world there for the World Fair, and they were sort of roped in to participating in this side event called Anthropology Days, which was attached alongside the Olympics to drum up interest in it. And Anthropology Days was essentially this thoroughgoingly racist affair set up by a U.S. sport honcho and an anthropologist that basically allowed this anthropologist to sort of test his pre-cooked theories about white superiority. And so they held a number of events that Native peoples from around the world participated in. The rules were often explained in English, so there wasn't clarity on what the rules were in all cases. And, you know, the 100-meter dash kind of thing, Rose, where you line up at the beginning and there's a tape at the end. what they found was in some of these heats, the native peoples would line up and they'd shoot off the gun and they'd all run toward the tape. And then instead of one person slamming through the tape at the end, people would wait at the end and all pass through the tape together. And while I might think and you might think, wow, that's fascinating. Look at that. These native peoples showing us at 1904 Olympics that there's other ways of construing competition. Well, for the racists that had this pre-cooked plan, that just showed that, these indigenous people from around the world are inferior. And white people are, of course, the natural athletes of the world. So I get at those stories that are much less pleasant, but I think important to realize as well.
And I love watching the opening ceremonies, just to look at the choreography, the dancing, the music. And I'm struck because now they actually have indigenous people performing.
Mm-hmm.
And so when did things start to change?
Well, I would say some of the key moments of indigenous participation in the opening ceremonies have to be the 1976 Olympics, where it wasn't so pretty. They had around 200 plus people pretending to be native people, dressed up in native clothing and dancing. And so it was fake natives, right? And they were dancing to a song called Danse Sauvage on top of it all. So that was the uglier side. There was a more positive way that First Nations people participated in the 2012 Olympics. There was something new at the 2010 Olympics in Vancouver, where there was something called the Four Host First Nation, where the Lillooet, Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples were hosts to a certain degree of the Olympics, and they had a much larger role in the opening ceremonies. But we shouldn't be thrown off by their participation. There was a lot of indigenous resistance to the 2010 Olympics. And in fact, one of the prime slogans there of the anti-Olympic movement was no Olympics on stolen native land, because the Olympics were happening on unceded Coast Salish territory there.
There's always a backstory.
Indeed.
Well, and you tell it so well in the book. We've got 30 seconds left. Are you hopeful that because these issues are now getting attention in the national media, international media, things will start to change?
I am hopeful. I think the conversations that are happening are really important right now. And I think that if we allow ourselves to escape the strong gravitational field of Olympic myth, where it's apolitical or where there's no other stories involved, if we allow ourselves to escape that, the Olympics become a lot more interesting, actually.
Jules Boykoff is author of the book Power Games, A Political History of the Olympics. He'll be speaking tonight at the Green Arcade Bookstore at 7 o'clock, 1680 Market Street in San Francisco. Jules, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, investigative journalist David K. Johnston joins us to talk about Donald Trump. Despite reports of tax evasion, three lawsuits alleging fraud, racist policy proposals, among other scandals, Trump officially clinched the GOP nomination on Tuesday. So who is he? And what does his political and economic history suggest about what a Trump presidency would look like? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.